my body. So I joined Deloitte and learned a lot about business in that period of time, and was flying a lot to different clients around the globe, and ended up finding this great guy and got married. And within a short period of time, I was promoted to manager at Deloitte, which was great. It was like, wow, I kind of made it. You know, I was came from nursing, and now I'm actually a manager in a corporation, and very exciting. And I found out a week later I was pregnant. And I said, oh, well, that really wasn't kind of in the planning. I didn't, you know, didn't expect that, but that's what happened. And so, you know, it was great working for a big company. And throughout the course of my pregnancy, funny little things started happening. I mean, I'm a nurse. I was kind of keeping an eye on. I was going to my regular scheduled OB visits. And the company said, hey, we've got a great project. It's an HR project. We're going to do this great new career development path program for Deloitte around the world, and we want you to be part of it. And then, guess what? For your last 7 or 8 weeks of your pregnancy, you can work from home. Fabulous. So there's one catch. You have to fly out to Chicago for the global introductory meeting with everybody. And so I checked with my OB. She said, yeah, this was, you know, several years ago. And she said, yeah, no problem. You know, you look, everything's fine. So I get there on Sunday night. I was going to be there for a one-day meeting. And I walked into the Deloitte offices in Chicago. And I didn't feel quite right. And it was early in the morning because I wanted to get in there and get things ready. And so I called my doctor back in Boston, Newton Wellesley Hospital. And she said, well, you really should go to the ER. And I said, really? Do I have to go to the ER? And she said, well, if there's nothing, it's nothing. And if it's something, that's good. So I got into the elevator at the Deloitte corporate offices in Chicago, and my water broke. That was not exactly planned. So here I am by myself in Chicago on a business trip where I was supposed to be there for one day. It was a total Seinfeld episode. I get in a cab. The water continues to break. It was like just one of these catastrophes of, you know, if anybody was filming it, it was had to be funny. Long story short, my daughter was born 7 weeks early as I was on a business trip in Chicago. Not exactly the way you plan for things to happen. And here I am trying to figure out the healthcare system. Luckily, my husband did make it with an hour to spare. But here I had a premature baby. I was a new manager at a great job, Deloitte, trying to figure out how all this stuff, you know, how was this all going to work? And ended up deciding at that point, these are some of the things that happen, you know, that you don't necessarily have control of over. And I said, I think it's time to probably look for a different job and get off the jet and be home because I have a premature daughter that I have to take care of. And it took a good 2 years. Now she's taller than me and at her first year of college and doing great. But those first 2 years were really hard on, you know, me as a businesswoman and as a mom, first child. And I know there's many women out in the audience. I know what the number and the statistic is or preterm birth here in this country. And it's something that we're all struggling to face. So fast forward. That's the episode behind me, and I think I'm doing pretty well now with my health. And I go in for my annual exam. Okay, maybe it wasn't my annual. Maybe it was, you know, 8 months or 24 months after I should have gone. And I went in, and I had my pap test. And I got the call. And they said, you know, we want you to come back and kind of take a look at this. And so I went back, and sure enough, it was something. And so here I found myself having to have some procedures. And luckily that was cleared up. Nothing major surgery. It was early diagnosis, which we're obviously all huge proponents of. So it was not a tremendous amount of surgery and follow-up treatment and things like that I needed. Fast forward 5 more years, and the surgery that I had had for the cervical abnormality started having really difficult periods, right? Anybody in the room have difficult periods? A couple, yeah. So, you know, to the point where I couldn't go to work a couple days a month because I was exhausted, because I couldn't wear the clothes that I wanted to wear because I would end up having to go home after certain accidents, right? The things that you don't want to happen. And so I ended up having an endometrial ablation procedure. Now, I can safely say that is now 5 or 6 years ago. It changed my life. I have no more of those issues. I'm able to get back on track with my health and wellness. And I tell this story simply for the fact that that was over the course of roughly, you know, 15 or 20 years of these different health issues that I faced. So how do we wrap these things in and try to stay focused on how do we take care of ourselves on a daily basis, right? And that's, it sounds easy. I mean, we all talk about, we've heard it all day long about how we need to make time to do different things. So, you know, we're going to talk a little bit now about those five steps that we really need to focus on. And they're not new or rocket science, but maybe some of the caveats and the things that we give to you today are things that you can take away from this and live it and try it. So we're going to talk about the first thing, and I think you've heard a lot of it. We just heard it actually from Ms. Blakely. If you have a health goal, first of all, identify what you want it to be, right? What is it? Is it that you want to feel better? Do you want to have more energy? Do you want to have more time to do some of the things that you want to do? Write it down, right? It is very powerful when you write something down and you socialize it amongst friends and family and you commit to it. To me, that's actually a really great start. Whether, again, you choose what that thing is that makes you want to make yourself feel better about. But, you know, Dr. Harvey, what's your thought on that as a good first step?
I think it's very important to set goals that are achievable. And so say the goal happens to be weight loss. Instead of thinking about the longer term of what that number is going to look like on the scale, think about someone just offered me a cookie and I said no thank you, right? And it's in the moment. And remember to be really positive about those choices that you make all along the way. And I find at work, my goals at work are, I always say yes, right? Yes, just I always say yes. We'll work out the details later. But that allows you to be the person at work who always says yes, and you'll be surprised how many goals you'll find that you're achieving. And while that's a little different from health, I think it's an important thing to think about in setting goals.
No, and it's so funny. So how many of you were here last year and saw Sondra Rhimes, right? And so I listened. So here's a takeaway, and here's actually a true story. So I had not read the book, but I picked it up and I had it as a book club read, and it's her book called The Year of Getting to Yes. It's so funny that you say that, because she's obviously a wonderful writer, but her story about how she did turn that around and how she learned that getting to yes got her out of her comfort zone. She was able to make those commitments. She was never an amazing speaker on stage. She had a great fear of it. But those are some of the things. If you go outside of your comfort zone and say yes to those things, it maybe you don't really, it's not where you would normally, you know, come from. It can make a huge difference. So, yeah, I agree. Say yes, write down your goals, socialize them, you know, with friends and family, and that's the first start. Because that's your commitment. That's the beginning of it. Well, the next one's easy, right? I mean, we hear it every day. There's all sorts of things on, TV and the news. Eating healthy, right? That sounds simple, right? We should all be able to choose to eat healthy. Except when you're working, you know, late at night till 6:30, 8 o'clock, whatever it is, and you're starving and you're driving along the highway and there's McDonald's. And you say, oh, I don't have anything in the fridge and this is going to be quick and easy, so I'm just going to stop and get McDonald's. But it gets back to that, you know, you make that simple choice of not eating at McDonald's and saying, you know what, I think I have an apple and maybe some peanut butter at home. That's what I'm going to go have. Making those choices sort of on a moment basis. One of the other things that I did in the last year, and it's funny because I had lunch with the COO recently, and he's like, what are you eating? And it was lunch. And I said, I've chosen to replace one meal a day with vegetables. Pure vegetables, that's all it is. And vegetables, don't forget, there are vegetables that have protein. His question was like, well, where's the protein? Well, this whole new science, the kale and all these vegetables have an amazing amount of protein in them, right? Which I never knew growing up. My mom would have loved that. So choosing to do something different and choosing to eat healthy, it's not about, you know, crazy diets and all of these things. I mean, yes, some of those can perhaps help because you make a commitment and things like Weight Watchers and places like that. But sometimes it's the simple. It's the simple choice of having water versus a soda. It's having, whatever, again, that vegetable replacement on your plate, or the size of that piece of chicken, which is supposed to be the size of your fist. I think you all know that as protein is what you should have. Making those choices as you are in the moment and at meals with friends and family. And I, you know, we were talking earlier about your healthy eating habits and some of the things that you suggest doing.
That I do and don't do. I guess my view is there are two components to eating, right? There's the nutrition and the calories, but there's also other things that we need to satisfy social with family and friends, and just the act of calming and celebrating that you're eating food, as opposed to eating 5 cookies sitting at your computer during lunch, when you are then left not really being aware that you've had a meal or satisfied all of those needs. So to try to celebrate the food, take some time to prepare it, and try to enjoy it. And I eat in the car. Not a great plan, right? It's not safe. It's not healthy. So just trying to move those things out. The other thing is don't eat standing up, right? The idea that those calories tend to not be noted by you when you're standing up and you're rushing. So just to celebrate and enjoy food so that it fulfills all of your nutrition needs, not just the calories.
And you made a comment as we were chatting, you know, sort of this is, there's a U.S. or sort of a way in the United States that we eat that is very different from perhaps some of the places where you visited, and maybe you can tell a little bit about that.
Well, I think we take food for granted in the U.S., and we're incredibly privileged, and we take food for granted. And some of the places I've worked in sub-Saharan Africa and other places, there's not ample food, and so it's challenging. But I think also in European cultures, where people do put more focus on the ritual of food, and that also sustains us in different ways and company when we do that. How many people actually sit down for a family dinner?
That's pretty good.
That's
actually
really good.
Yeah.
I mean, it's so easy to get caught up in the, you know, someone's got to be at soccer, someone else is, my kids play these weird sports, so I'll try to think of other, tennis, like
fencing.
So you've got to be in all these places, and it's so easy to put that aside. And maybe it's too late in the evening, or because you're home late from work. It's facilitated for me because my husband cooks, which is fantastic. But it's also something that we can be healthy about hiring out. If the problem is time, you can make healthy choices having someone else prepare some of the food as well. But the ritual, I think, is really important.
Absolutely, and I'm very impressed and glad to see so many people having
family meals. Yeah, it's fantastic.
I think we should get back to that as much as we can. So the third thing, near and dear to my heart, because it's one of those love-hate relationships, right, is exercise. And I think there are these huge peaks and then big valleys that I experience with exercise. It's sort of that I feel really good when I'm doing it, and then all of a sudden I'm traveling for 3 weeks, and you know, if I walk between here and the hotel room and back, that's about as much exercise as I get. But you know, what's interesting is there's some simple apps. So I was in a conversation about a month ago with a colleague, and they said, "Geez, have you tried the 7-minute app? Have you seen that on the iPhone?" And I said, what are you talking about? 7 minutes, right? That's funny. So I downloaded it, and apparently it was a corporate initiative, I think, maybe by, I can't think of the name of the company, but it was a corporate initiative because so many other people were traveling, and they said, yeah, when you sit there and you say, okay, I got to get my stuff on, I got to drive to the gym, I got to work out and at least be sweating, so that's at least another half an hour, take a shower and get back home, that's, you know, there's an hour and a half, right? And that seems impossible. Like, I can't possibly get that fit into my day. I've got meetings from 8 till 7:30, and forget it, then I'm tired. Like, I want to have a glass of wine. I don't want to go work out. So
that's another nutrition topic. Yeah.
That's a whole nother thing. Exactly. But so I tried it. I downloaded the app, and I will tell you, it's funny. It's a little bit of a CrossFit thing. And I'm not advertising for the 7-Minute app, but these are little tidbits that if they work for you, try it. And I will tell you that I hurt the next day in 7 minutes. Far more than if I had actually run 3 or 5 miles, because it was sort of this CrossFit where you're doing all those things. The only thing I would highly recommend, if you're in a hotel room and you're doing the 7-Minute app, just be on the first floor. I literally got a call, a noise call, like a wake up, could you please quiet down? Because the jumping jacks were really loud at whatever time of the day. So, but it is, there are creative ways to find exercise. Parking, and one of the other things I've done, which is actually good because we've gone through in our facility, tremendous construction, and they're redoing our entire office building. So they've shifted all the different parking lots, and at first I was grumbling about it, like, oh my God, I have to go park and walk so far. And then I thought, wow, I actually have to walk farther. So I then made it a choice to actually park furthest away from the building just to get that exercise. Like that, you should allow yourself that additional, even if I'm going to be 5 minutes, you know, potentially late to a meeting, that's actually better than rushing in and getting 10 steps. And by the way, so I have a little step. Our company actually has a, as part of the Virgin Pulse company, you know, fitness program. And that's the other thing is, if you're in a company that doesn't have that, advocate for it, because it's made a huge difference, I think, personally and for many of our employees. Ali Bibu, who spoke earlier today, was a big champion of bringing this in. And I'll tell you, we have little communities around this. So, you know, how many steps do you do? And, you know, there's little challenges that come out. And I honestly feel like I have lost, I've definitely lost weight. I feel better. And it's something that simple. I mean, we can do that. We can encourage each other to do that and be healthy. Now, you are a tremendous, you're not in that, you're mostly in the peak. I don't think you hit the valleys in terms of your exercise routine.
So, I am a recovering exercise addict. And I have three brothers. Can you believe I survived that? They're all older. It was sheer hell growing up with them. And one of my brothers is a psychologist, and he's done a lot of different research over the years. And I am not exaggerating, he wrote a book about me. And there is a physiology of addiction to exercise. It relates to endorphins. And given all the addictions one can have, it's probably a fairly good one. But nonetheless, it is an obsession. And so I have run regularly since I was about 13, and I am feeling my aging is a privilege, but I am feeling my age. And so now what I do when I run is I have a neighbor who runs. I run at a time in the morning when no one can schedule a meeting, no kid can find me, and my husband certainly wouldn't be out of bed. I run about 5 o'clock in the morning, but I meet my neighbor. She also works. We're the only two in our entire neighborhood who work, so we're very close, which bonds us, and we run about 5 o'clock in the morning. So my advice is don't become addicted, but find a friend that you're going to meet, because when the alarm goes off and you know someone else is getting dressed and their alarm is going off, it is a huge motivator. And it doesn't mean that you'll be best friends with that person, and it doesn't mean you're going to run. Maybe you're going to whatever. Just if you have that connection with someone, and we have solved every problem in the world on our runs. I mean, seriously, if only people would call us, we'd be great. The other thing that we do, and I would encourage people to do because I find it motivating, is there's an, we keep talking about apps, sorry, but there's an app.
There are some great ones, though.
Charity Miles. Anyone heard of Charity Miles? Awesome. So Charity Miles, you download on your iPhone. If you're doing inside walking or running, outdoor walking and running or biking, it records your mileage. It does burn your data a little bit and your battery. And there is a company which sponsors each day. And there's a list of charities. I always do Stand Up to Cancer. And so it records. So I've run, since I started doing this, I can't remember, a little over a year ago, I'm up to 2,000 miles. And so we're, you know, it really makes a difference. We also, I like I said, I was addicted to this, so I have to keep talking. radiologists are physicians, so we go to medical school, and most people, and we do sit in the dark, that is true. And most of us don't see patients, but in breast imaging, we do. We see patients all day long, but most of us are very sedentary. So we have a chair, an interim chair in our department right now, and we're doing walking meetings. So our department has walked, not in a straight line, mind you, from Baltimore to Portland, Oregon, and we're back to New York. And that's in just a few months. So, you know, if you can do one walking meeting, one little bit, it really does motivate you to get up and move. And we were not meant to sit, right? We do it all the time, but that's not how we're structured. So right now, I'll stop.
No, that's awesome. And it's the walking meeting, it's interesting that you said that because, yeah, you know, I'd either go to my employee's office or have them come to mine, and we'd sit there. And all of a sudden, it did strike me, and so I started this a little while ago, too, that, you know, we walk maybe to go grab a cup of coffee or something, yeah. And have the conversation along the way, right? Ask your boss to do that. Be surprised. I think that everybody, it just changes the dynamic. It makes it a little friendlier. There's not a separation, potentially. You know, it makes for a better relationship, and you're getting some exercise in, so... Lots of good things. So write your goals down, eating healthy and making those choices in the moment, choosing the exercise. The next one, I think, is the one that maybe we forget a lot because we don't identify it, and it's really focusing on your mental health, right? I mean, we hear about it. We talk about work-life balance. We talk about stress reduction. But in the course of a day, you know, how many of us allow ourselves the time to actually focus on that mental health? And so one of the things that I started doing, and again, I don't know what we did before iPhones, honestly, like they're amazing, but I look for that time in my day when I can actually have some meditative moments or listen to some HBR podcast to expand my mind and learning. Where I love to be is I'm a learning person, so I always want to be absorbing new things and then being able to have those as part of discussion later in the day, right? So my commute is often an hour plus. I live in Western Mass, so any given day on the Pike, if there's an accident, it could be 2.5. But so what do you do with that time? And so I would actually put on that time HBR podcast or something like that, or a meditative, not that I'm driving, I am driving safely, but something to help you think through and clear your head a little bit to start the day. Meditation is an amazing thing, and I used to, not that, I mean, I, as an oncology nurse, we practice that a lot of times. We'd be practicing it at night with the patients, right? When the families were gone and everybody else was there, we'd spend that time because it was quiet. And you think that it has to be quiet to have a meditative moment. It doesn't have to be. You have to find those moments and that time in your day to make that something that is given to you. It's a gift. Give yourself that gift of meditation when you can in the day. And you have a sort of a more extreme story, I think, around meditation and how to manage stress.
So literally 21 years ago today.
Today,
I had our first child, Caroline. And she was early, and I had preeclampsia and then eclampsia, and I had seizures and was in the ICU. It was an unpleasant situation, and my recovery from that took quite some time. And I maintained some poor renal function and also very high blood pressure after. And it was challenging for the physicians to figure out what really the physiology of that was. So they prescribed for me a cardiac rehab program that was centered at Beth Israel. And so this was a 12-week intensive program. We went 3 evenings a week. So it was a huge commitment. And bear in mind, I had a baby at home. I can't even believe I survived this. I had a baby at home. I was a fellow in training, and my husband was consulting for CSC Index. Is CSC still here even?
It's I don't know if it is, but I remember the name of the company.
Anyway, and so he was on the road all week. And then I got on top of this 3 nights a week of going to this program. But it was absolutely fantastic. It was a combination of meditation, exercise, and just mindfulness. And it was around all sorts of things. And sometimes they were combined. And I'm not combined in that exercise and meditation would be combined. And you're thinking, what? But you can do both. If you know how to set that up, or if someone is guiding you to set it up. And I am not suggesting that any of you go through and do an intensive 12-week program, but I can say that even pieces of that can be something that you make a habit for your entire life. And it was life-altering for me, and sometimes I wish they would re-prescribe it so I could go back, but it really, it was incredible. So if you just picked out a piece of that, and that program started literally with about 10 minutes a day, and, you know, just a little bit of your day, and we can all fit it in. So it's worth considering.
One of the other things that, you know, we talk about stress, right? And you think about those moments throughout your day. I mean, you could look ahead at your day or your week. You can probably pick out what the stressful moments are going to be. But identifying that stressful moment and thinking about it in perhaps a different way and mentally preparing differently for that day or that moment could also be very helpful. And it was funny, we were chatting earlier, too, about one of my stressful moments. My husband would, if he were here, we'd certainly chime in on this. Dinner parties, right? Like, I try to make the Pinterest dinner party look perfect. All the plates have to be exactly right, the flowers, and now, like, I have to go get some crafting materials from Michael's to make this whole new thing in the centerpiece. But you were sharing, actually, a really simple idea there about how to make that stress-free or stress-less.
And I do think of work as being my primary stress, but you can make stress anywhere you want, right? Dinner party, we can all pile it on. So the what we started to do, we moved to Baltimore in 2005, and we moved into the house that we live in 2006. Anyone know anything about Baltimore? It's a small town, right? And if you didn't grow up there, you've got no friends. I'm telling you, they're just like, it's very close. When people say, where did you go to school? They mean high school. They're not talking about college or, you know, like, I mean, at Hopkins, people say, where'd you go to school? It's not medical school, high school. I'm like, oh, for God's sakes. So I decided if we didn't do something, we were going to be alone and we'd have to look at each other and our children every night and it was going to be really miserable. So the first New Year's we were in our house, my resolution was that we were going to have a dinner party at least once a month. Because I figured if I invited people, they would have to invite me back. It's a little Southern. There's a little Southern hospitality. So we started doing that. And at first it was, you know, I've got to go buy flowers and I've got to do this and I've got to clean the dust bunnies up. And it has, over the years, evolved to a process where when we have people come in, if there's something in the yard that I can put on the table, that's great and it happens. And if there's not, that's okay. Sometimes we have goofy things that we put out, but a lot of times people arrive before the table is set. So we all do that together. And people help to some degree participate in getting the food organized and then cleaning up. And we have gained more fun and had less stress by evolving it. And I think if people don't enjoy that, maybe you don't want them to come. Right? They're not really your type. It's worked really well, and we have people almost every week in our house, just because it is it's a pleasure, and my husband cooks,
which is great.
So he's a really good cook.
No, I think that's great. I think certainly thinking about, again, the stressors, it could be something as simple as a dinner party that you actually de-stress and make better. So the last thing, and I talked about it a little earlier, you know, with my personal experience of skipping a pap test, you know, or my pap test annually, and, you know, it's the health and wellness visits. So that's part of owning your annual physical, right? Making that time commitment in your year to go and have your visit and get checked. And it's incredibly hard. It seems like, when we were talking about this earlier too, that I remember trying to schedule it, and it seemed like it just kept, and that probably was that year of having a really difficult time doing that. But it's important to know the schedules of the things that you should be having, right? So there are the ACOG, the American College of Obstetrics and Gynecology Well Woman Guidelines. Have people ever heard of that? Just show of hands. Okay, so that wasn't very many, so I'm really glad. Yeah. I'm gonna have people come up if you didn't know what that is, but look it up. It's the ACOG Well Woman Guidelines, and it goes through the screenings that you should be having, or those different tests and checkups that you should be having. In general, I'll just kind of highlight them. Young women, beginning age 13 to 18, should be in for their sort of first visit. History and physicals, discussions around sexual activity in terms of sexually transmitted diseases, starting to have some of those conversations. I know the first time that my daughter went in and the doc said, Mom, are you coming, or is it okay if she come? You know, she goes without me. And I sat there and I thought, no, I want to be there. And then I thought, all right, no, this is part of her life and her story, and she needs to own her health now as well and feel comfortable telling the truth to a clinician. And so I sat there at whatever she was, 15, and I said, nope, she needs to go. And make sure that she develops that good relationship with her physician and clinicians to feel comfortable to have those discussions that she certainly at that age didn't want to have with me. Now, I don't know what the story was. I'm hoping that I'm still naive to the fact that that might have been the case, but we know the numbers. We know that younger kids are having those types of activities, so we can't kid ourselves. So encouraging our daughters to have those visits and discussions to make sure that they are staying healthy. 19 to 39 is usually around the time that pap test and HPV screening kind of kicks in. 40 to 64 is when mammography starts. Around age 45, you start doing your cardiac and lipid profiles for cardiac risk. And then colonoscopy at 50, and then 65 and plus, they add in the bone mineral density for osteoporosis. All of those are the guidelines, but the reality is every woman in this room has probably a slightly different risk from the other, right? Our histories, our family background, the experiences of our lives are really those things that we need to be more versed in and have those discussions early so that we can be better planful and mindful and have good discussions. And understand some of those, the implications of those different phases of our lives. You know, I talked about, my experience and yours as well with, you know, perinatal health and knowing that there are tests and things available out there to look for preterm risk. Our company is actually one of the ones that happens to produce that. I didn't know that before I joined, but, you know, very proud of the technologies that we have to focus on women's health throughout the entire life cycle of a woman. But I know you have some interesting kind of thoughts around, you know, where screening is today and some of the battles that are out there and perhaps the confusion amongst women in the U.S. today.
So given that I specialize in breast imaging, that's when I hear this question, that's what I relate it to. So of course I'm leaving out a whole lot of other health issues, but I can speak to what I know. I think the recommendations are confusing, and I think they are produced based on the perspective of the organization writing the recommendations. So the U.S. Preventive Services Task Force thinks about this in terms of what's the cost to the United States to screen women. And so they make guidelines that fit that. They're not necessarily interested in identifying the most cancers, right? That may not be their primary perspective or goal. American Cancer Society, similarly, while they're interested certainly in cancer detection, their primary goal isn't necessarily that every single cancer be identified as early as possible. As a breast imager, I feel like that is what I do. That is my life. And so I would say it is absolutely critical that women start, average risk women, start screening at 40 and come every year. The data is extremely clear. That is the best way to find the most cancers. I know there's a lot of conversation that breast cancer isn't real and that there's overdiagnosis and overtreatment. And the problem with that is that nobody has that information. We're not going to ask Mrs. Smith versus Mrs. Jones to have Mrs. Smith's breast cancer treated and Mrs. Jones is watched. We are not going to do that with invasive breast cancer. So at this point, without greater knowledge, we have to assume that all breast cancers are dangerous to women's lives. And I think it's remarkable that a woman dies every minute in the world from breast cancer. So while we sit in this room, 60 women will die of breast cancer. And that's an underestimate because in low resource areas, we don't have great data. And I think as much as I like to complain about aging and aching and getting gray hair, aging is a privilege. And there are a lot of women who, including my sister-in-law, who would have loved to age, right? It wasn't possible for her. So if we look at it in that way, then screening is one of those things that may allow you to grow old and grow old in a healthy way. So I think it's important to take the time if you can. I know it's hard to schedule. I completely get it. But there might be ways, we have habits, right? So maybe around your birthday, that's when you call every year to schedule your mammogram and your GYN appointment, your wellness visits. Or maybe it's the holidays that you do it, you call near the holidays and you do it after. Or it's summer because your work is less busy in the summer. But just getting into a pattern of doing this, because it really is important to you and your family. When women die of breast cancer, on average, they're 19 years of life lost. So if you have young children, think of the things that your family and friends would miss if you left here 19 years too early. So I do think it's worth making time for trying to get in. And mammography is not perfect, but it's better than nothing. There's absolutely no question. So, my
very powerful statements. Actually, that's it's sobering when you think that statistic of one per minute in the time that we'll be here. 60 women around the world will have passed away is definitely sobering, and all the more reason to take charge of our health and do these sort of simple five things and live them as you can every day. It is busy. It's a challenge, but taking time to write down your goals, be it getting my annual visit, yes, and making sure that I'm educated going in and knowing the questions that needed to be asked, getting the right information, eating healthy, exercising, again, the new 7-minute app, I highly recommend it. Mental health, right? Getting that time on your day to spend a few moments of meditation or whatever it is. Is it music? Something that gives you some time that you can focus on your mental health, and de-stress where possible. And then, obviously, the health and wellness visits, which are really critical. And not, I think it's not just for you. It's we as women are responsible for our elderly parents and our children's visits and all of those things. And it's making sure that we're doing that not just for them, but for ourselves as well, and making that commitment. So I think that was pretty much where we were coming. I don't know if we'd like to switch over to questions from the audience or other great ideas that you could share around health that has worked for you.
When you talk about meditation, I'm around 50 all the time, and I set silent alarms. I will stop whenever if I lose, and I take 5 minutes.
That's wonderful.
Did everyone
hear
that?
A great idea. Yeah, I don't know if everybody heard that. So she has a Fitbit, and she can actually schedule times throughout the day that will alarm her to meditate. And she takes those quick 5 or 10 minute, Fitbit breaks to actually go ahead and meditate. That's so you're scheduling it, right? I mean, you're scheduling it into your day.
I'm scheduled to get out of my chair because I, you know, I work with a computer all the time, and so I need to remember to get up, walk around, even remind myself to go to the bathroom because I become so engrossed in what I'm doing.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Setting yourself for healthy reminders throughout the day.
Yeah.
I think we have a question coming up over here.
Hi.
What you said about the mammogram recommendation versus your recommendation was really interesting. Recently, I noticed that my gynecologist had started reducing the recommendation on a pap smear as well. And I was worried, and I was thinking about how that must be an insurance thing or some other recommendation. And I'm thinking about, as the insurance industry will probably become less equality-based in the near future, the health insurance industry, are there other things that we should be advocating for ourselves that may not, in your opinion, be in line with the recommendations?
Well, for example, there's a new mammography technology, 3D and or tomosynthesis, and there is no question it is a better tool. Used with reconstructed 2D images, the radiation dose is identical, or in the ballpark, identical. Not every woman has an identical radiation dose. It's based on lots of different features, but it absolutely is a better tool. More cancers are identified and fewer false alarms occur. And that's true in our data. We have information that shows we've decreased our recall rate or our false alarms 52%, and our cancer detection rate is up 45%. And that those numbers are true in Europe and throughout the U.S. It is absolutely a better tool. Insurance companies do not always pay for this. And that's been something that I personally have worked on in the state of Maryland. We're trying to get legislation through. It's back up. It got tabled last year. But I think that's something that recommendations may not provide and is clearly a better tool.
What's it called again?
It's called 3D mammography or tomosynthesis.
And actually to highlight, so this is great. I mean, our company, obviously, we are a women's health company. We are one of the manufacturers of this technology. Mm-hmm. For those of you that haven't seen it, the bus downstairs, you can go take a look. But in the state of Massachusetts, I believe, Meg, was it about a week ago, 2 weeks ago, that Blue Cross Blue Shield of Massachusetts now covers 3D mammography. And Harvard Pilgrim. That's new. I didn't know that. So Harvard Pilgrim as well. And Cigna as well, correct? So that was as of last year they didn't. So the insurance companies are now starting to cover. So do be educated on the choices of your health and the new things. I mean, there's a lot of hype of science. It's really funny. There's some great YouTube videos of, you know, what you see on TV and what's real in terms of the actual data and the science versus what is promoted, and I think it's critical for women to be educated and very well versed on
what
that
data. Are there good sources you'd recommend for that? Sorry, I have so many questions about that.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
It's great.
Is there a resource?
Our website, for example, and I bet Brigham and Women's and other MGH probably has information on the website, so you could go to those sources. The American Cancer Society has some things on. We've written it, so.
There's a website called healthywomen.org, and they have a lot of basic information about screenings, and it's true information. It's not slanted towards one way or the other, but they're up to date on all the current guidelines, and it's a good full circle.
Thank you.
Thank you. Great question.
There's one other thing I think in choosing where you have your imaging, and again, I know I'm focusing on breast, but it's just it's what I do. It's important to know what equipment the facility has, and that's easy. You simply ask what equipment they're using, and at this time, film screen mammography really shouldn't. There may be a few centers in the country, but it is not up-to-date equipment. 3D mammography, as I was saying, is without question a better tool, but also who interprets the mammogram. They're on websites in Maryland. You can go to the state of Maryland and find out which centers are breast centers of excellence based on the ACR. And so that is something that can also help you understand who's interpreting your mammogram. And I appreciate we at Hopkins are very fortunate that we subspecialize. And so it is unique, but nonetheless, there is broad support in the literature that specialists have better performance interpreting mammography than generalists. So it's worth asking the question and doing a little bit of research, because it can mean the difference between an earlier detection or not.
I recently was told by my doctor, actually not recently, a couple of years ago, that I no longer needed pap smears because I was beyond the age of 65, and they don't do pap smears anymore. And yet when I was looking at statistics, the largest incidence of cervical cancer is women over 65. Is there a reason for that? I mean, why would they not?
This is part of being sort of educated. It's funny because my mother is 83 and so here's the difference. And she lives in Massachusetts, in Western Mass, and she still is offered a pap test. So there are variations. I think that's where it becomes choice. I mean, some people may say, yeah, I'm not at risk and I really don't choose to, and that's fine. But if you feel that is still important, there may be other familial pieces and things that are part of your risk profile, to advocate for yourself.
Well, and I did. They were not happy about it, but I did.
And Lori, I think that's the one thing we all have to do as women is advocate for yourself. Mm-hmm. Because, the doctor will say, oh, you don't need that, or you need this, and you might not need this. You have to go in educated with your own health, your own risk on whatever it is. Cannot rely on doctors. No offense, Dr. Harvey. Like, say, this is more on the well woman exam. Here are all the things you need. Here are all the things you don't need. You have to participate in your health. Just as we advocate for ourselves for equal pay, that job, you have to advocate for what is right for you. You're the only person who knows your risk. Your doctor can help you with that risk, but you have to communicate. And if you don't go in with the information, they're going to just go down the list and say, here's what we're going to recommend based on guidelines, which is fine, but you have to know your risk and what's going on with yourself. And be honest, and they ask your girlfriends. I know it's a crazy conversation, but like the abnormal bleeding situation, a lot of women don't talk about it, so they're like, oh, it's normal. But when you start talking to your friends, it's not so normal. And you have to talk to people and not be informed.
And Meg's part of the team. She's my BFF at work, so she's like my, call a friend, I call Meg, so she just stands up in the audience.
I think she's exactly right, too. The first thing I said was, that's not acceptable. So start scheduling.
Good for you.
Hi, my name is Christine. I work at Sanofi, and I'm glad to be here today. I came in a few minutes after you both started speaking, so I know the first thing I missed was talking about healthy eating. I wanted to get your feelings on if either of you have an opinion on eating organically. I'm not sure if I missed this, if you spoke about it, but eating organically and eating non-GMO foods.
That's a great question. I'm not sure I'm versed to be able to talk about that. I don't know if you have any data or...
I have an opinion.
Yeah, I have
an
opinion,
I'm
too.
But I'm not sure that... I don't have a medical opinion. Because it's... I'm sorry, it's just... It really just isn't my area. I think... that organic foods are better for our world, and we all live here, and we need to take care of this space. And again, I have opinions, but I can't say to you, oh, there's 6 studies that show breast cancer declines when women eat organic foods.
But personally, I guess, I'm asking, what is
personally,
your...
Personally, absolutely.
Okay.
Yes.
My personal opinion is absolutely... Okay. Organic foods, and there are also foods. I work with a woman, Sarah Sukumar, and Sarah is a PhD in our in oncology at the Sydney Kimmel Cancer Center. And Sarah's I think she's about 68. She looks about 40, and she was one of the people who described oncogenes. So she's a very famous woman. And she's working, she and I are working on several projects, but one of the things she's looking at is turmeric as a preventive method for inflammation and mutations, so therefore as an anti-cancer, an anti-cancer method. It's not a drug. I don't want to say drug. An anti...
Like prevention.
No,
it's sort of a method of prevention,
That you can have daily.
Right.
And it's sold in compounded. Some of those compounds you absorb well and others you don't. And her recommendation is that it be heated in some sort of oil substance. So if you're making eggs, for example, and you're going to put them in butter, or whatever oil you're using, just put a little turmeric in it and cook your eggs, and there you have it. And so there are many ways that our nutrition can assist us in being healthy.
But your question is a great one. It was something that somebody else was saying. You know, I think there could probably be a recommendation for a whole nutrition session for next year. I think it'd actually be great because I think there's
fantastic.
A lot. We talked about it at a high level, but for those phases of your life, for those periods when you're going through, I mean, there's all sorts of different diseases mm-hmm. that what you put into your body will make a difference. There's no question about that. Just as we know, if anybody, you know, what's the crazy McDonald's show, right? You know, where you just eat McDonald's, and I don't mean, this is not against McDonald's, but anything over, what is it? Supersize Me.
Yeah.
Right? We saw what happened with that, right? So I mean, it makes sense that there is probably some great superfoods out there that if we made those choices on a daily basis, we could be feeling and living longer.
Great. Thank you.
Thank you. Any other questions? I think we're coming right up on 4 o'clock. Oh, yeah, great.
What about making sleep a priority? I think a lot of times that kind of falls out. Do you guys think
Oh my gosh. So that's the other. So her question, if you guys didn't hear it, is making sleep a priority. You know what's, and I will, so my colleagues from work may now know a secret that I actually think sleep is one of the most important things. And I used to work these crazy hours and, you know, get three or four hours of sleep. And you think that that's like a badge. Like, oh, I only had to sleep 3 or 4 hours last night, right? And then you realize 2 days later when you're driving home and your head's bobbing and you're like, oh, my God, and I just had 8 cups of coffee and I'm trying to stay awake. There's definitely healthy benefits to sleeping. And you hear it. I mean, they're advertising it a lot more. They're talking about changing, you know, the time that kids go to high school because they don't get enough sleep. And one of the biggest reasons for car accidents is people that are drowsy, right? I mean, it is not a small impact to society. But there again, giving yourself that privilege, like I actually make myself get 8 hours of sleep at night. Unless I wake up in 7 and then I know it's time to get up. But I make that commitment. And the other thing I've done, because for those of you that have a partner that snores, anybody, I wear earplugs to bed, and I get the best sleep. I've been doing it now for a while, but it's quiet, and it actually, I will then get that 7 or 8 hours that my body needs. I definitely would not underestimate the need for sleep and prevention of, you know, colds and illnesses and all of those things is critically important. Your body has to regenerate itself. All right, that's my...
slight clinical opinion.
I was at a similar conference in Baltimore recently, and had the good fortune of sitting with someone who's a sleep doctor. So one of the questions that was asked of him was, how do you know how much sleep you need? So the way you can figure that out, because we are different in that, right? 8 hours is sort of the prescribed, but everyone is a little different. So if you went to bed on a Friday night and you didn't set your alarm and you woke up and you did that several Friday nights and it was 8 hours, then the answer for you is 8 hours. And it might be 6 for someone else. There are all kinds of studies showing that insomnia and difficulty with sleep can be related to early onset of Alzheimer's. It is a critically important part of health and it is overlooked. There's, you know, it's easy to do. I have a colleague who was having difficulties at work with memory and other cognitive issues, and it turned out that she had sleep apnea. Mm. And she's not your typical person that you would expect to have sleep apnea, and it has changed her life, getting appropriate amounts of sleep. So I think if you have questions, there are sleep centers all over, and you don't have to go to a sleep center. You can do this at home. There are ways to monitor your sleep at home. And I think it's critical information. It can really change your life.
Great question. All right. Well, thank you so much for joining us today. Really appreciate it. Hopefully it was good information. Sure.